Even if he is a medical doctor, don't bother looking in the yellow pages under physicians, because this guy is up in years and he's got to be retired. Here, she said. Fogarty, Dr. Lawrence J. There's an address? Yes. She tore the page out of the book. Great. As soon as you've seen the infamous Pollard place, we'll pay Fogarty a visit. Though Bobby had visited the house three times, he had traveled there with Frank, and he had not known the precise location of 1458 Pacific Hill Road any more than he had known exactly what flank of Mount Fuji that trail had ascended. They found it easily enough, however, by following the directions they received from a long-haired guy with a handlebar mustache at a Union 76 station. Though the houses along Pacific Hill Road enjoyed an El Encanto Heights address, they were actually neither in that suburb nor in Goleta, which separated El Encanto from Santa Barbara, but in a narrow band of county land that lay between the two and that led east into a wilderness preserve of mesquite, chaparral, desert brush, and pockets of California live oaks and other hardy trees. The Pollard House was near the end of Pacific Hill, on the edge of developed land, with few neighbors. Oriented west-southwest, it overlooked the charmed, Pacific-facing community so beautifully sited on the terraced hills below. At night, the view was spectacular, a sea of lights leading to a real sea cloaked in darkness. And no doubt the immediate neighborhood remained rural and free of expensive new houses only because of development restrictions related to the proximity of the preserve. Bobby recognized the Pollard place at once. The headlights revealed little more than the Eugenia hedge and the rusted iron gate between two tall stone pilasters. He slowed as they went by it. The ground floor was dark. In one upstairs room, a light was on. A pale glow leaked around the edges of a drawn blind. Leaning over to look past Bobby, Julie said, "Can't see much." "There isn't much to see. It's a crumbling pile." They drove over a quarter of a mile to the end of the road, turned, and went back. Coming downhill, the house was on Julie's side, and she insisted he slow to a crawl to allow her more time to study it. As they eased past the gate, Bobby saw a light on at the back of the house, too, on the first floor. He couldn't actually see a lighted window, just the glow that fell through it and painted a pale, frosty rectangle on the side yard. "It's all hidden in shadows," Julie said at last, turning to look back at the property as it fell behind them. "But I can see enough to know that it's a bad place." "Very," Bobby said.
Violet lay on her back on the bed in her dark room with her sister, warmed by the cats which were draped over them and huddled around them. Verbena lay on her right side, cuddled against Violet, one hand on Violet's breasts, her lips against Violet's bare shoulder, her warm breath spilling across Violet's smooth skin. They were not settling down to sleep. Neither of them cared to sleep at night, for that was the wild time, when a greater number and variety of nature's hunters were on the prowl, and life was more exciting. At that moment, they were not merely in each other, and in all of the cats that shared the bed with them, but in a hungry owl that soared the night, scanning the earth for mice that weren't wise enough to fear the gloom and remain in burrows. No creature had night vision as sharp as the owl, and its claws and beak were even sharper. Violet shivered in anticipation of the moment when a mouse or other small creature would be seen below, slipping through tall grass that it believed offered concealment. From past experience, she knew the terror and pain of the prey, the savage glee of the hunter, and she yearned now to experience both again, simultaneously. At her side, Verbena murmured dreamily. Swooping high, gliding, spiraling down, swooping up again, the owl had not yet seen its dinner when the car came up the hill and slowed almost to a stop in front of the Pollard house. It drew Violet's attention, of course, and through her, the attention of the owl, but she lost interest when the car speeded up again and drove on. Seconds later, however, her interest was renewed when it returned and coasted almost to a stop once more at the front gate. She directed the owl to circle the vehicle at a height of about 60 feet. Then she sent it out ahead of the car and brought it even lower to about 20 feet before guiding it around again to approach the curious motorist head-on. From an altitude of only 20 feet, the vision of the owl was more than acute enough to see the driver and the passenger in the front seat. There was a woman Violet had never seen before, but the driver was familiar. A moment later, she realized that he was the man who had appeared with Frank in the backyard at twilight that very same day. Frank had killed their precious Samantha, for which Frank must die. And now here was a man who knew Frank, who might lead them to Frank. And on the bed around Violet, the other cat stirred and made low, growling sounds as her passion for vengeance was transmitted to them. A tailless Manx and a black mongrel leaped from the bed, raced through the open bedroom door, down the steps, into the kitchen, out the pet door, around the house and into the street. The car was moving away, gaining speed, heading downhill, and Violet wanted to pursue it not only by air, but on foot, to ensure that she would not lose track of it. Kendi arrived in the reception lounge at Dakota and Dakota. Cool cross-drafts circulated from the broken window in the next room, and two open doors in this one setting up opposing currents. The faint sounds announcing his arrival had evidently been masked by the bursts of static and harsh voices coming from the portable police radios that the cops had clipped to their belts. One policeman stood in the entrance to Julian Bobby's private office, and the other was at the open door to the sixth floor corridor. Each of them was talking to someone out of sight, and both had their backs turned to Kendi, which Kendi knew was a sign that God was still looking out for him. Though he was angered by this obstacle to his search for the Dakotas, he got out of there at once, materializing in his bedroom nearly 150 miles to the north. He needed time to think if there was some way that he could pick up their trail again, a place where they had been tonight, besides their office and their house, at which he could seek more visions of them.
When they backtracked to the Union 76 station, the long-haired, mustachioed man who had given them directions to Pacific Hill Road was able to tell them how to find the street on which Fogarty lived. He even knew the man. Nice old guy, stops by here for gas now and then. Is he a medical doctor? Bobby asked. Used to be. I've been retired quite a while. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Bobby parked at the curb in front of Lawrence Fogarty's house. It was a quaint Spanish two-story with the style of French windows that had been featured in the study to which Bobby and Frank had twice traveled, and lights were on throughout the first floor. The glass in the many panes was beveled, at least on the front of the house, and the lamplight inside was warmly refracted by those cut edges. When Bobby and Julie got out of the car, he smelled wood smoke and saw a homey white curl rising from a chimney into the still, cool, humid pre-storm air. In the odd and vaguely purple crepuscular glow of a nearby street lamp, a few pink flowers were visible on the azaleas, but the bushes were not as laden with early blooms as those farther south in Orange County. An ancient tree with a multiple trunk and enormous branches loomed over more than half the house, so it seemed like a wonderfully cozy and sheltered haven in some Spanish version of a hobbity fantasy world. As they followed the front walkway, something dashed between two low Malibu lights, crossed their path, and startled Julie. It stopped on the lawn after passing them and studied them with radiant green eyes. "Just a cat," Bobby said. Usually, he liked cats. But when he saw this one, he shivered. It moved again, vanishing into shadows and shrubs at the side of the house. What spooked him was not this particular creature, but the memory of the feline horde at the Pollard house, which had raced to attack him and Frank, in eerie silence initially, but then with the shrill, single-voiced squeal of a banshee regiment, and with a most uncat-like unanimity of purpose. On the prowl alone, swift and curious, this cat was quite ordinary, possessed only of the mystery and haughtiness common to every member of his species. At the end of the walk, Three front steps led up to an archway through which they entered a small veranda. Julie rang the bell, which was soft and musical, and when no one answered, after half a minute, she rang it again. As the second set of chimes faded, the stillness was disturbed by the rustle of feathered wings as some nightbird settled onto the veranda roof above them. When Julie was about to reach for the bell push again, the porch light came on, and Bobby sensed that they were being scrutinized through the security lens. After a moment, the door opened, and Dr. Fogarty stood before them, in an outfall of light from the hall behind him. He looked the same as Bobby remembered him, and he recognized Bobby as well. "Come in," he said, stepping aside to admit them. "I half expected you. Come in. Not that any of you is welcome." "In the library," Fogarty said, leading them back through the hall to a room on the left. The library, where Frank had taken him during their travels, was the place Bobby had referred to as the study when he had described it to Julie. As the exterior of the house had a hobbity fantasy coziness, in spite of its Spanish style, so this room seemed exactly the sort of place where one imagined that Tolkien, on many a long Oxford evening, had taken pen to paper to create the adventures of Frodo. That warm and welcoming space was gently illuminated by a brass floor lamp and a stained glass table lamp that was either a genuine Tiffany or an excellent imitation. Books lined the walls under a deeply coffered ceiling, and a thick Chinese carpet, dark green and beige around the border, mostly pale green in the middle, graced a dark tongue-and-groove oak floor. The water-clear finish on the large mahogany desk had a deep luster. On the green felt blotter, the elements of a gold-plated, bone-handled desk set, including a letter opener, magnifying glass, and scissors, were lined up neatly behind a gold fountain pen in a square marble holder. The Queen Anne sofa was upholstered in a tapestry that perfectly complemented the carpet, and when Bobby turned back to look at the wing-backed chair where he'd first seen Fogarty earlier in the day, he twitched with astonishment at the sight of Frank. "Something's happened to him," Fogarty said, pointing to Frank. He was unaware of Bobby and Julie's surprise, apparently operating under the assumption that they had come to his house specifically because they had known they would find Frank there. Frank's physical appearance had deteriorated since Bobby had last seen him at 5:26 that afternoon in the office in Newport Beach. If his eyes had been sunken then, they were as deep as pits now. The dark rings around them had widened, too, and some of the blackness seemed to have leached out of those bruises to impart a deathly gray tint to the rest of his face. His previous pallor had looked healthy by comparison. The worst thing about him, however, was the blank expression with which he regarded them. No recognition lit his eyes. He seemed to be staring through them. His facial muscles were slack. His mouth hung open about an inch, as if he had started to speak a long time ago, but had not yet managed to remember the first word of what he wanted to say. At Cielo Vista Care Home, Bobby had seen only a few patients with faces as empty as this, but they had been among the most severely retarded, several steps down the ladder from Thomas. "How long has he been here?" Bobby asked, moving toward Frank. Julie seized his arm and held him back. "Don't." "He arrived shortly before 7 o'clock, Fogarty said. So Frank had traveled for nearly another hour and a half after he had returned Bobby to the office. Fogarty said, "He's been here over 3 hours, and I don't know what the blazing hell I'm supposed to do with him. Now and then he comes around a little bit, looks at you when you talk to him, even responds more or less to what you say. Then sometimes he's positively garrulous, runs on and on, won't answer your question, but sure wants to talk at a person. Couldn't shut him up with a two before. He told me a lot about you, for instance, more than I care to know." He frowned and shook his head. "You two may be crazy enough to get involved in this nightmare, but I'm not, and I resent being dragged into it." At first glance, the impression that Dr. Lawrence Fogarty made was that of a kindly grandfather who in his day had been the type of devoted and selfless physician who became revered by his community, known and beloved by one and all. He was still wearing the slippers, gray slacks, white shirt, and blue cardigan in which Bobby had first seen him earlier. And the image was completed by a pair of half-lens reading glasses over which he regarded them. With his thick white hair, blue eyes, and gentle, rounded features, he would have made a perfect Santa Claus if he'd been 50 or 60 pounds heavier. But on a second and closer look, his blue eyes were too steely, not warm. His rounded features were too soft, and revealed not gentility so much as a lack of character, as though they had been acquired through a lifetime of self-indulgence. His wide mouth would have given kindly old Doc Fogarty a winning smile, but its generous dimensions served equally well to lend the look of a predator to the real Doc Fogarty. "So Frank's told you about us," Bobby said, "but we don't know anything about you, and I think we need to." Fogarty scowled. "Better that you don't know about me. Better by far for me. Just get him out of here and take him away."
"You want us to take Frank off your hands?" Julie said coldly.
"Then you've got to tell us who you are, how you fit into this, what you know about it." Meeting Julie's gaze, then Bobby's, the old man said, "He's not been here in 5 years. Today, when he came with you, Dakota, I was shocked. I thought I'd finished with him forever. And when he came back tonight..."
Frank's eyes had not focused, but he had cocked his head to one side. His mouth was still ajar, like the door to a room from which the resident has fled in haste. Regarding Frank sourly, Fogarty said, "I've never seen him like this, either. I wouldn't want him on my hands if he was his old self, let alone when he's half a vegetable."
All right, we'll talk. But once we've talked, he's your responsibility."
Fogarty went behind the mahogany desk and sat in a chair that was upholstered in the same dark maroon leather as was the wingback in which Frank slumped. Although their host had not offered them a seat, Bobby went to the sofa. Julie followed and slipped past him at the last moment, sitting on the end of the sofa closest to Frank. She favored Bobby with a look that essentially said, "You're too impulsive. If he groans or sighs or blows a spit bubble, you'll put a hand on him to comfort him, and then you'll be gone in a wink to Hoboken or hell, so keep your distance." Removing his tortoiseshell reading glasses and putting them on the blotter, Fogarty squeezed his eyes shut and pinched the bridge of his nose between thumb and forefinger, as if to banish a headache with an effort of will, or collect his thoughts, or both. Then he opened his eyes, blinked at them across the desk, and said, "I'm the doctor who delivered Roselle Pollard when she was born 46 years ago, February 1946. I'm also the doctor who delivered each of her kids, Frank, the twins, and James, or Candy, as he now prefers. Over the years, I treated Frank for the usual childhood adolescent illnesses, and I guess that's why he thinks he can come to me now, when he's in trouble. Well, he's wrong. I'm no goddamn TV doctor who wants to be everybody's confidant and Dutch uncle. I treated them, they paid me, and that should be the end of it. Fact is, I only ever really treated Frank and his mother, because the girls and James never got sick, unless we're talking mental illness, in which case they were sick at birth and never got well." Because Frank's head was tilted, a thin, silver stream of drool slipped out the right corner of his mouth and along his chin. Julie said, "You evidently know about the powers her children have."
"I didn't know, really, until 7 years ago, the day that Frank killed her. I was retired by then, but he came to me, told me more than I ever wanted to know, dragged me into this nightmare, wanted me to help. How could I help? How could anyone help? It's none of my business anyway."
"But why do they have these powers?" Julie said. "Do you have any clue, any theories?" Fogarty laughed. It was a hard, sour laugh that would have dispelled any illusions Bobby had about him if those illusions had not already been dispelled 2 minutes after he'd met the man.
"Oh, yes. I have theories, lots of information to support the theories, too. Some of it's stuff you'll wish you never heard. I'm not going to get myself involved in the mess, not me. But I can't help now and then thinking about it. Who could? It's a sick and twisted and fascinating mess. My theory
is that it starts with Roselle's father. Supposedly her father was some itinerant who knocked up her mother, but I always knew that was a lie. Her father was Yarnell Pollard, her mother's brother. Roselle was a child of rape and incest. A look of distress must have crossed Bobby's face or Julie's, for Fogarty let out another bark of cold laughter, clearly amused by their sympathetic response. The old physician said, "Oh, that's nothing. That's the least of it."
The tailless Manx, Zitha by name, took up sentry duty in the concealment of an azalea shrub near the front door. The old Spanish house had exterior window ledges, and the second cat, as black as midnight and named Darkle, sprang to another one in search of the room to which the old man had taken the younger man and woman. Darkle put his nose to the glass. A set of interior shutters inhibited snooping, but the wide louvers were only half closed, and Darkle was able to see several cross-sections of the room by raising or lowering his head. Hearing Frank's name spoken, the cat stiffened, because Violet had stiffened in her bed, high on Pacific Hill. The old man was there among the books, and the couple as well. When everyone sat down, Darkle had to lower his head to peer between another pair of tilted louvers. Then he saw that Frank was not only one of the subjects of their conversation, but actually present in a high-backed chair that stood at just enough of an angle to the window to reveal part of his face and one hand lying limply on the wide maroon leather arm.
Leaning over his desk and smiling humorously as he talked, Doc Fogarty resembled a troll that had crawled out from its lair beneath a bridge, not content to wait for unsuspecting children to pass by, prepared to forage for his grisly dinner. Bobby reminded himself not to let his imagination run away with him. He needed to keep an unbiased perspective on Fogarty in order to determine the truthfulness and value of what the old man had to tell them. Their lives might depend on it. The house was built in the 30s by Dieter and Elizabeth Pollard. He'd made some money in Hollywood producing a bunch of cheap westerns, other junk, not a fortune, but enough that he was fairly sure he could give up films in Los Angeles, which he hated, move up here, get into some small business, and do all right for the rest of his life. They had two children. Yarnell was 15 when they came here in 1938, and Cynthia was only 6 years old. In 45, when Dieter and Elizabeth were killed in a car crash hit head-on by a drunk driving a truck full of cabbages down from the Santa Ynez Valley, if you can believe it, Yarnell became the man of the house at age 22, and the legal guardian of his 13-year-old sister. Julie said, "And forced himself on her, you said?" Fogarty nodded. "I'm sure of it. Because over the next year, Cynthia became withdrawn, weepy. People attributed it to the death of her folks, but it was Yarnell using her, I think. Not just because he wanted sex, though she was a pretty little thing, and you could hardly fault his taste, but because being the man of the house appealed to him. He liked authority, and he was the type who wasn't happy until his authority was absolute, his dominance complete." Bobby was horrified by the words, "You could hardly fault his taste," and what they implied about the depth of the moral abyss in which Fogarty lived. Oblivious of the disgust with which his visitors were regarding him, Fogarty continued. "Yarnell was strong-willed, reckless, caused his folks a lot of heartache before they died, all kinds of heartache, but mostly related to drugs. He was an acid head before they had a name for it, before they even had LSD, peyote, mescaline, all of the natural hallucinogens you can distill from certain cactuses and mushrooms and other fungi. It wasn't the drug culture back then that we have now, but crap was around. He got into hallucinogens through a relationship he had with a character actor who appeared in a lot of his father's movies. Got started when he was 15. And I tell you all this because my theory is it's the key to everything you want to know." "The fact that Yarnell was an acid head," Julie said, "that's the key? That and the fact he impregnated his own sister.
The chemicals probably did genetic damage, and a lot of it by the time he was 22. They usually do. In his case, some very strange genetic damage. And then when you add in the fact that the gene pool was very limited, being as Cynthia was his sister, you might expect there's a high chance the offspring will be a freak of some kind. Frank made a low sound, then sighed. They all looked at him, but he was still detached. Though his eyes blinked rapidly for a moment, they did not come back into focus. Saliva still drooled from the right corner of his mouth. A string of it hung from his chin. Though Bobby felt he should get some Kleenex and blot Frank's face, he restrained himself, largely because he was afraid of Julie's reaction. So, about a year after their parents died, Yarnell and Cynthia came to me. She was pregnant, Fogarty said. They had this story about some itinerant farm worker raping her, but it didn't ring true, and I pretty much figured out the real story just watching how they were with each other. She tried to conceal the pregnancy by wearing loose clothes and by staying in the house entirely during her last few months, and I never could understand that behavior. It was as if they thought the problem would just go away one day. By the time they came to me, abortion was out of the question. Hell, she was in the early stages of labor. The longer they listened to Fogarty, the more it seemed to Bobby that the air in the library was foul and growing fouler, thick with a humidity as sour as sweat. Claiming he wanted to protect Cynthia as much as possible from public scorn, Yarnell offered me a pretty fat fee if I'd keep her out of the hospital and deliver the baby right in my office, which was a little risky, in case there were complications. But I needed the money, and if anything really went wrong, there were ways to cover it. I had this nurse at the time who could assist me, Norma. She was pretty flexible about things. Oh, just great, Bobby thought. A sociopathic physician had found himself a sociopathic nurse. A couple who would be right in the social swim of things among the medical staff of Dachau or Auschwitz. Julie put a hand on Bobby's knee and squeezed, as if the contact reassured her that she was not listening to a mad doctor in a dream. You should have seen what came out of that girl's oven, Fogarty said. A freak it was, just as you'd expect. Wait a minute, Julie said. I thought you said the baby was Roselle, Frank's mother.
It was, Fogarty said. And she was such a spectacular little freak that she'd have been worth a fortune to any carnival sideshow willing to risk the anger of the lotto exhibitor.
He paused, enjoying their anticipation. She was an hermaphrodite. For a moment, the word meant nothing to Bobby, and then he said, You don't mean she had both sexes, male and female?
Oh, but that's exactly what I mean. Fogarty bounced up from his chair and began to pace, suddenly energized by the conversation. Hermaphroditism is an extremely rare birth defect in humans. It's an amazing thing to have the opportunity to deliver one. You have transverse hermaphroditism, where you have the external organs of one sex and the internal of the other. Lateral hermaphroditism, several other types, but the thing is, Roselle was the rarest of all. She possessed the complete internal and external organs of both sexes.
He plucked a thick medical reference book from one of the shelves and handed it to Julie. Check page 146 for photos of the thing I'm talking about. Julie handed the volume to Bobby so fast it seemed as if she thought it was a snake. Bobby, in turn, put it beside himself on the sofa unopened. The last thing he needed, with his imagination, was the assistance of clinical photographs. His hands and feet had gone cold, as though the blood had rushed from his extremities to his head to nourish his brain, which was spinning furiously. He wished that he could stop thinking about what Fogarty was telling them. It was gross. But the worst thing about it was, judging by the physician's strange smile, Bobby sensed that what they had heard thus far was all just the bread on this horror sandwich. The meat was yet to come. Pacing again, Fogarty said, Her vagina was about where you'd expect, the male equipment somewhat displaced. Urination was through the male part, but the female appeared reproductively complete.
I think we get the picture, Julie said. We don't need all the technical details. Fogarty came to them, stood looking down at them, and his eyes were as bright and lively as if he were recounting a charming medical anecdote that had bewitched legions of delighted companions at dinner parties over the years. No, 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 no. You must understand what she was if you're going to understand all that happened next.
Though her own mind was split into many parts, sharing the bodies of Verbena, all the cats, and the owl on Fogarty's porch roof, Violet was most acutely aware of what she was receiving through the senses of Darkle, as he perched upon the windowsill outside the study. With the cat's sharp hearing, Violet missed not a word of the conversation in spite of the intervening pane of glass. She was enthralled. She seldom paused to think about her mother, although Roselle was still in this old house in so many ways. She seldom thought about any human being, for that matter, except herself and her twin sister, less often Candy and Frank, because she had so little in common with other people. Her life was with the wild things. In them, emotions were so much more primitive and intense, pleasure so much more easily found and enjoyed without guilt. She hadn't really known her mother or been close to her, and Violet would not have been close even if her mother had been willing to share affection with anyone but Candy. But now, Violet was riveted by what Fogarty was telling them, not because it was news to her, which it was, but because anything that affected Roselle's life this completely also had profound effects on Violet's life. And of the countless attitudes and perceptions that Violet had absorbed from the myriad wild creatures whose minds and bodies she shared, a fascination with self was perhaps paramount. She had an animal's narcissistic preoccupation with grooming, with her own wants and needs. From her point of view, nothing in the world was of interest unless it served her, satisfied her, or affected the possibility of her future happiness. Dimly, she realized that she should find her brother and tell him that Frank was less than 2 miles away from them. Not long ago, she had heard the wind music of Candy's return.
Fogarty turned away from Bobby and Julie and circled behind his desk again, where he walked along the bookshelves, snapping his finger against the spines of volumes to punctuate his story. As the physician spoke of this family who had seemingly sought genetic catastrophe, Julie could not help but think of how Thomas's affliction had been visited upon them, even though his parents had lived healthy and normal lives. Fate played as cruelly with the innocent as with the guilty. When he saw the baby's abnormality, I think Yarnell would have killed it, thrown it out with the garbage, or at least put it in the hands of an institution. But Cynthia wouldn't part with it. She said it was her child, deformed or not, and she named it Roselle, after her dead grandmother. I suspect she wanted to keep it largely because she saw how it repulsed him. And she wanted to have Roselle around as a permanent reminder to him of the consequences of what he had forced her to do. "Couldn't surgery have been used to make her one sex or another?" Bobby asked. "Easier today. Iffier then." Fogarty had stopped at the desk, where he had removed a bottle of wild turkey in a glass from one of the side drawers. He poured a few ounces of bourbon for himself and recapped the bottle without offering them a drink. That was fine with Julie. Though Fogarty's house was spotless, she wouldn't have felt clean after drinking or eating anything in it. After taking a swallow of the warm bourbon neat, Fogarty said, "Besides, wouldn't want to remove one set of organs, only to discover that as the child grew older, it proved to look and act more like the sex you'd denied it than like the one it was permitted. Secondary sex characteristics are visible in infants, of course, but not as easily read, certainly not in 1946. Anyway, Cynthia wouldn't have authorized surgery. Remember what I said? She probably welcomed the child's deformity as a weapon against her brother." "You could have stepped between them and the baby," Bobby said. "You could have brought the child's plight to the attention of public health authorities." "Why on earth would I want to do that? For the psychological well-being of the child, you mean? Don't be naive." He drank some more bourbon.
I was well paid to make the delivery and keep my mouth shut about it, and that was fine by me. They took her home, stuck to their story about the itinerant rapist.
Julie said, the baby, Roselle, she had no serious medical problems?
None, Fogarty said. Other than this abnormality, she was as healthy as a horse. Her mental skills and her body developed right on schedule, like any child. And before long, it became obvious to all outward appearances that she was going to look like a woman. As she grew even older, you could see she'd never be an attractive filly, mind you. More on the sturdy side than a fashion model, thick legs and all that, but quite feminine enough.
Frank remained vacant-eyed and detached, but a muscle in his left cheek twitched twice. The bourbon apparently relaxed the physician, for he sat behind his desk again, leaned forward, and clasped his hands around the glass.
In 1959, when Roselle was 13, Cynthia died. Killed herself, actually, blew her brains out. The following year, about 7 months after his sister's suicide, Yarnell came to the office with his daughter, that is, with Roselle. He never called her his daughter, maintaining the fiction that she was only his bastard niece. Anyway, Roselle was pregnant at 14, same age at which Cynthia had given birth to her. Good God, Bobby said.
The shocks kept piling one on top another, with such speed that Julie was almost ready to grab the whiskey bottle off the desk, drink straight from it, and never mind that it was Fogarty's booze. Enjoying their reactions, Fogarty sipped the bourbon and gave them time to absorb the shock. Julie said, "Yarnell raped the daughter he had fathered by his own sister?" Fogarty waited a little longer, savoring the moment. Then, "No."
No. He found the girl repellent, and I'm confident he wouldn't have touched her. I'm sure what Roselle told me was the truth. He sipped more bourbon. Cynthia had developed quite a religious streak between the time she gave birth to Roselle and the day she killed herself, and she'd passed on that passion for God to Roselle. The girl knew the Bible backward and forward. So Roselle came in here pregnant. She said she decided she should have a child. Said God had made her special. That's what she called hermaphroditism. Special. Because she was to be a pure vessel by which blessed children could be brought into the world. Therefore, she had collected the semen from her male half and mechanically inserted it into her female half.
Bobby shot up from the sofa as if one of its springs had broken under him, and he grabbed the bottle of wild turkey from the desk. "You have another glass?" Fogarty pointed to a bar cabinet in the corner, which Julie had not noticed before. Bobby opened the double doors, revealing not only more glasses, but additional fifths of wild turkey. Evidently, the physician kept a bottle in his desk drawer, only so he would not have to walk across the room for it. Bobby poured two glasses full, with no ice, and brought one back to Julie. To Fogarty, she said, "Of course, I never thought Roselle was barren. She did bear children, we know that. But I assumed you meant the male part of her was sterile.
Fertile as a male and as a female. She couldn't actually join herself to herself, so to speak, so she resorted to artificial insemination, as I said."
Late that afternoon, in the office in Newport, when Bobby had tried to explain how traveling with Frank was like bobsled riding off the edge of the world, Julie had not really understood why he was so unnerved by the experience. Now she thought she had an inkling of what he had meant, for the chaos of the Pollard family's relationships and sexual identities made her skin crawl and fill her with a dark suspicion that nature was even stranger and more hospitable to anarchy than she had feared.
"Yarnell wanted me to abort the fetus, and abortion was a fairly lucrative sideline in those days, though illegal and hush-hush. But the girl had hidden her pregnancy from him for about 7 months, as he and Cynthia had tried to hide a pregnancy 14 years earlier. It was much too late for an abortion then. The girl would have died, hemorrhaging. Besides, I would no more have aborted that fetus than I'd have shot myself in the foot. Imagine the degree of inbreeding involved here. the hermaphroditic child of brother-sister incest impregnates herself. Her child's mother is also its father. Its grandmother is also its great-aunt. And its grandfather is its great-uncle. One tight genetic line. And genes damaged by Yarnell's use of hallucinogenics, remember. Virtually a guarantee of a freak of one kind or another, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Julie took a long swallow of the bourbon. It tasted sour and stung her throat. She didn't care. She needed it.
I'd become a doctor because the pay was good, Fogarty said. Later, when I gravitated toward illegal abortions, the pay was better. And it became a main business. Not much danger, either, because I knew what I was doing, and I could buy off an authority now and then if I had to. When you're getting those fat fees, you don't have to schedule many office visits. You can have a lot of free time, money, and leisure, the best of both worlds. But having settled for a career like that, what I never figured was that I'd encounter anything as medically interesting, as fascinating, as entertaining as this Pollard mess.
The only consideration that caused Julie to refrain from going across the room and kicking the crap out of the old man was not his age, but the fact that he would leave the story unfinished and some vital piece of information unrevealed.
But the birth of Roselle's first child wasn't the event I thought it would be, Fogarty said. In spite of the odds, the baby she produced was healthy and, from all indications, perfectly normal. That was 1960, and the baby was Frank.
In the wing-back chair, Frank whimpered softly, but remained in a semi-comatose condition.
Still listening to Doc Fogarty through Darkle, Violet sat up and swung her bare legs over the edge of the bed, dispossessing some of the cats from their resting places and eliciting a murmur of protest from Verbena, who was seldom content to share just a mental link with her sister, and needed the reassurance of physical contact. With cats swarming at her feet, seeing through their eyes as well as her own, and therefore not blinded by the darkness, Violet started toward the open door to the lightless upstairs hall. Then she remembered that she was nude, and she turned back for panties and a T-shirt. She wasn't afraid of Candy's disapproval or of Candy himself. In fact, she would welcome his violent attentions, for that would be the ultimate game of hunter and prey, hawk and mouse, brother and sister. Candy was the only wild creature into whose mind she couldn't intrude. Though wild, he was also human and beyond the reach of her powers. If he tore out her throat, however, then her blood would get into him, and she would become a part of him in the only manner she ever could. Likewise, that was the only way he could get into her, by biting his way in, by chewing into her, the only way. On any other night, she would have called to him and let him see her nude, with the hope that her shamelessness would at last provoke him to violence. But she could not pursue her fondest desire right now, not when Frank was nearby and still unpunished for what he had done to their poor puss, Samantha. When she addressed, she returned to the hall, moved along it in the gloom, still in complete touch with Darkle and Zitha and the wild world, and stopped before the door to their mother's room, into which Candy had moved upon her death. A thin light of light showed along the sill. "Candy," she said. "Candy, are you there?"
Like a memory from wars past, or a presentiment of an ultimate war to come, a searing flash of lightning and a sky-shattering crash of thunder shook the night. The windows of the study vibrated. It was the first thunder Bobby had heard since the faint and distant peal when they had come out of the motel nearly an hour and a half ago. In spite of the fireworks in the sky, rain was not yet falling. But though the tempest was slow-moving, it was almost upon them. The pyrotechnics of the storm was an ideal backdrop to Fogarty's tale.
"I was disappointed in Frank," Fogarty said, taking a second bottle of bourbon from his capacious desk drawer and refilling his glass. "No fun at all. So normal. But 2 years later she was pregnant again. This time the delivery was every bit as entertaining as I'd expected Frank's to be. A baby boy again, and she called him James. Her second virgin birth, she said. And she didn't mind at all that he was as much of a mess as she was. She said that was proof that he, too, was favored by God and brought into the world without a need to wallow in the depravity of sex. I knew then she was as mad as a hatter.
Bobby knew he had to remain sober, and he was aware of the danger of too much bourbon after a night of too little sleep. But he had a hunch that he was burning it off as fast as he drank it, at least for now. He took another sip before he said, "You're not telling us that beefy hulk is hermaphroditic, too?"
"Oh, no," Fogarty said. "Worse than that."
Candy opened the door.
"What do you want?"
"He's here, in town, right now," she said. His eyes widened.
"You mean Frank?"
"Yes."
"Worse," Bobby said numbly.
He got up from the sofa long enough to put his glass on the desk. It was still three quarters full, but he suddenly decided that even bourbon would not be an effective tranquilizer in this case. Julie had reached the same conclusion and put her glass aside, too.
James, or Candy, if you wish, was born with four testes instead of two, but with no male organ. Now, at birth, male infants carry all their testes safely in their abdominal cavity, and the testes descend later during infant maturation. But Candy's never descended and never could, because there was no scrotum for them to descend into. And for another thing, there's a strange excrescence of bone that would prevent their descent, so they've remained within his abdominal cavity. But I would guess they functioned well, busily producing quite large amounts of testosterone, which is related to development of musculature and partly explains his formidable size.
"So he's incapable of having sex," Bobby said.
"With his testicles undescended and no organ for copulation, I'd say he's got a shot at being the most chaste man who ever lived."
Bobby had come to loathe the old man's laugh. "But with four gonads, he's producing a flood of testosterone. And that does more than help build muscles, doesn't it?"
Fogarty nodded. "To put it in the language of a medical journal, excess testosterone over an extended period of time alters normal brain function, sometimes radically, and is a causative factor of socially unacceptable levels of aggression." "To put it in layman's language, this guy is seriously stoked with sexual tension he can't possibly release. He's rechanneled that energy into other outlets, mainly acts of incredible violence. And he's as dangerous as any monster any movie maker ever dreamed up."
Although she had released the owl as the storm drew near, Violet still inhabited Darkle and Zetha, taking their fear away from them when the lightning flared and the thunder boomed. Even as she stood before Candy at the door to his room, she was listening to Fogarty tell the Dakotas about her brother's deformity. She knew about it already, of course, for within the family their mother had referred to it as God's sign that Candy was the most special of all of them. Likewise, and in some way, Violet had been aware that this deformity was related to the great wildness in Candy, the thing that made him so powerfully attractive. Now, she stood before him, wanting to touch his huge arms, feel the sculpted muscles, but she restrained herself.
"He's at Fogarty's house."
That surprised him.
"Mother said Fogarty was an instrument of God. He brought us into the world. Four virgin births. Why would he harbor Frank? Frank's on the dark side now."